divers laid the pod, and her spooks had listened in for about a week. The submarine pulled out for comparatively safer waters, before heading back in a week later to monitor the cable again. Grafe may have been giving the recorders time to accumulate extra data for short-term review. The more likely alternative is that she came back in to add a second recorder, or to lay a second tap in a new spot. That's what had been done in Okhotsk. Besides, the extra recording capacity would have been needed. Parchi was scheduled for an overhaul after this mission, and wouldn't come back to the Barents for 2 years. Parchi finally came home after being at sea for 137 days. For this endurance op, she won another PUC, maintaining her streak of one presidential unit citation for every trip to the Barents. This PUC, her fourth in 4 years, was signed by Reagan, who also sent Grafe a box of cigars. The certificate used the standard language about extraordinary heroism, but then it went on to say that Parchi had established new standards for endurance and excellence in underwater operations. The president had immortalized the Navy's cover story. With Parchi scheduled to be in overhaul throughout 1983, there was no other submarine that could be trusted to service the Barents cable tap. Seawolf was in the shipyard, recovering from storm damage, but her days of tapping Soviet cables were clearly over. Naval intelligence never imagined Seawolf clunking and banging around the Barents, and the Soviets' discovery of the Okhotsk tap had ended any tapping missions in that sea. When Seawolf finally did emerge from the yards, she would mainly be used to search for pieces of test missiles and other Soviet hardware in the open ocean. By now, the Navy also had modified its two newest mini-subs, Turtle and Seacliff, to go much deeper than their original maximum of 6,500 feet, and among other things, they were to help recover the pieces of test missiles that Seawolf found and that Air Force or Navy radar had tracked through death smacks into the ocean. Turtle had been refitted in 1979 to go to 10,000 feet. Seacliff was given a titanium sphere in the early 1980s to enable it to reach 20,000 feet, making it the first Navy vessel since Trieste I to go as deep as John Craven had envisioned when he was dreaming of a fleet of deep submergence search vehicles in the 1960s. Still, unlike the DSSVs Craven envisioned, both submersibles had to be hauled to dive sites on surface ships. It also was still just drawing up plans to convert the USS Richard B. Russell, SSN 687, into its fourth and final special projects sub. So naval intelligence was without its best source of information during what would become one of the most tense years of the Cold War since détente. The Navy was trying to learn how to trail the Soviets under the ice by following them there from their ports. But as the U.S. Navy sent more and more attack subs, the number of skirmishes with the Soviets in the Arctic increased. Not only that, trailing the Soviets under the ice was proving difficult. The Navy was most successful in the deep polar regions, where the waters had sound properties most like those of the open ocean. That wasn't the case in the marginal ice zones. Still, the Navy had no choice but to keep trying. There was enough Soviet activity that Admiral James Watkins, who had succeeded Hayward as CNO, finally told the American public that the latest front in the Cold War had moved far up north. And he said, "If there are forces in that area, we'd better know how to fight them." He added, "The ice is a beautiful place to hide." It was now more critical than ever for naval intelligence to spread what it was learning about Soviet tactics and strategy throughout the subforce. The captains and spooks on regular surveillance subs were filing thicker patrol reports than ever, and even much of the information from the cable taps, once tightly guarded, was being distributed to submarine officers, although first sanitized to disguise the source. Naval intelligence was so desperate to outthink the Soviets that it was even willing to rely on a little knowledgeable guesswork. A group of submariners and analysts were gathered and told to write up what they thought would be found in a Soviet submarine operating manual. When that was done, they were sent to visit and brief attack submarine commanders on what they might expect to face at sea. By now it was clear that no one else was going to champion Rickover's idea for a special class of Arctic subs. Instead, the Navy had decided to try to give ICE capabilities to nearly 24 remaining Los Angeles-class subs, still scheduled for construction. Conceived as open-ocean aircraft carrier escorts, the original LA-class subs lacked some of the sophisticated electronic surveillance equipment and ICE-capable sonar that had been built into Parchie and other sturgeon boats. That had left the nation's newest subs unable to handle what had become the most crucial spying operations as easily as the boats they were replacing. Lyon had been asked to help research what changes were needed to allow the L.A. boats to do better under the ice, but his funding never seemed to come through. While under-ice operations were increasingly focused on attempts to develop torpedoes and sonar that could better distinguish between ice ridges and missile subs in the deep polar regions, Lyon kept arguing that the fleet commanders were ignoring the greatest problem, that no U.S. sub had the ability to hunt or maneuver well enough to fight within the marginal ice, where he was certain the Soviets were most likely to hide. Nobody of rank, it seemed, wanted to hear it. Just as the Soviet sea threat was growing, relations between the superpowers were disintegrating. Yuri V. Andropov, a former director of the KGB who had succeeded Leonid Brezhnev as the Soviet leader in 1982, was spinning apocalyptic visions of a U.S. first strike that even many KGB experts saw as alarmist. Then Reagan began stirring Soviet fears. On March 8, 1983, he out-preached the preachers at the convention of the National Association of Evangelicals held that year in Orlando, Florida. He offered a laundry list of national and international evils: abortion, teen pregnancy, clinics providing teen birth control. After an impassioned plea for school prayer, he turned his attention to the Soviet Union. "Yes, let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God," Reagan intoned. "But until they do, let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world." Moments later, he concluded, "So, in your discussions of the nuclear freeze proposals, I urge you to beware the temptation of pride, the temptation of blithely declaring yourselves above it all, and label both sides equally at fault, to ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong, and good and evil." Reagan had equated the fight against communism as the fight between good and evil before, but the phrase "evil empire" became one of those sound bites that gets repeated over and over. It definitely captured the fearful attention of the Soviets. Their concern that Reagan might consider a first strike was bolstered on March 23rd, when, less than 2 weeks after his evil empire speech, the president went on television to introduce the world to Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. At first, the Soviets saw this plan to orbit lasers designed to blast Soviet missiles out of the sky as impractical. But Reagan's rhetoric, as interpreted by the KGB, further convinced some Soviet officials that the president was capable of ordering a first strike. The Soviets weren't calmed either when, shortly after the Evil Empire and Star Wars speeches, the U.S. Pacific Fleet began its largest maneuvers since World War II. Navy warplanes from the carriers Midway and Enterprise flew over Soviet military installations on the Kuril Islands that marked the entrance to the Sea of Okhotsk. The show of force was another step in Lehman's efforts to get the Soviets' attention. Following that, crucial arms control talks stalled as the Soviets protested a U.S. plan to place low-flying cruise missiles and Pershing II intermediate-range ballistic missiles in West Germany and Italy. Then, on August 31st, the Soviets shot down a Korean Airlines passenger plane, KAL-007, which had veered over Soviet military bases near the Sea of Okhotsk. All 269 people on board were killed. Reagan accused the Soviets of premeditated murder, of knowingly shooting down the civilian airliner. Rather than admit that they had made a lethal mistake, the Soviets claimed that the airliner was a CIA reconnaissance plane. Following the KAL incident, Soviet students at U.S. universities were called home on the grounds that anti-Soviet sentiment put them in physical danger. By the time Lech Wałęsa won the Nobel Peace Prize on October 6th, the KGB was convinced that the award was part of a Western Zionist plot to destabilize Eastern Europe. Tensions mounted further on October 26th, when Reagan ordered the invasion of Grenada. The United States claimed it was rescuing American medical students, but in the process, it overthrew the infant communist government. As all this was going on, the KGB was actively looking for signs that NATO and the United States were considering a first strike. The search, now a top priority, had been started by Andropov when he was still heading the KGB. It was codenamed Operation Ryan, for the Russian term for nuclear missile attack, Rakietna Yadernaya Napadyenia. According to Oleg Gordievsky, a high-ranking KGB officer who later defected to England, the KGB throughout 1983 was pressuring Soviet agents around the globe to feed Ryan, to report alarming information even if they were skeptical of it themselves. In the wake of the KAL shootdown, the KGB pushed Ryan agents even harder. By now, Andropov had fallen gravely ill, and one of his kidneys had been removed. He had not been seen in public since mid-August, but he was still in charge, and he still believed the world could be heading toward nuclear Armageddon. In the midst of all this tension, the Soviets sent a Victor III submarine to waters somewhere between the Carolinas and Bermuda. The Americans countered, sending a frigate, the USS McCloy, and a submarine, the USS Philadelphia, SSN 690, to trail the Victor. Before anyone knew it, the boats were all engaged in a tug of war, or was it a game of soccer? It happened on October 31st, 1983, and the prize was some of the best sonar technology the Americans had. The Victor moved in close to the frigate and accidentally snagged the ship's towed sonar array, tearing it free from American grasp. But within moments, the Victor was on the surface and floundering, her prize wrapped around her propeller. She had been disabled by her own intelligence coup. That much made the U.S. newspapers. But what happened next has never been reported. Philadelphia's crew maneuvered near the Victor, then went in tight and below to check out the sub. The next thing anyone knew, the array was wrapped around the Philadelphia. The Americans had inadvertently snatched it back. With Operation Ryan running wild and nearly unchecked, Gordievsky says there was a real danger of a catastrophic mistake. That was never more true, he says, than during November NATO exercises codenamed Able Archer. From November 2nd to November 11th, the NATO forces were practicing release procedures for tactical nuclear weapons, moving through all of the alert stages from readiness to general alert. Because the Soviets' own contingency plans for war called for real preparations to be shrouded under similar exercises, alarmists within the KGB came to believe that the NATO forces had been placed on an actual alert. Ryan teams were given orders to look for signs that NATO was about to start a countdown toward nuclear war, last-minute crisis negotiations between Britain and the United States, food industry efforts to stockpile, such as mass butchering of cattle or evacuations of political, financial, and military leaders and their families. The Soviet alerts eased after November 11th, when Able Archer came to an end. But there was little easing of the paranoia. That December, Marshal Nikolai V. Ogarkov, chief of staff of the Soviet Armed Forces, made a stunning public pronouncement. He said that the Soviets believed the United States would still like to launch a decapitating nuclear first strike. Reagan's Secretary of State, George P. Shultz, met Ogarkov's announcement with outright disbelief. Shultz was certain that this had to be just more talk. But in January 1984, the Soviets followed through on a threat made during the dispute over the Pershing II missiles. Offering their own show of force, they sent some Delta missile submarines back out into the Atlantic to cruise off U.S. shores along with the Yankees that were still routinely patrolling there. The aim was to show that the Deltas could hit targets throughout the United States as easily as the Pershings in Germany could target the Soviet Union. Ironically, the Soviet move actually put the Deltas just where the U.S. Navy could track them most easily. But the implied threat was nonetheless clear. Both sides were stepping up the normal cat-and-mouse game, trailing one another more aggressively than ever. The Reagan administration now realized that it had to try to calm things down. The incendiary rhetoric in Washington came to an abrupt halt. Shultz began talking privately with Soviet diplomats to try to dispel the tension and renew a dialogue about arms control. Reagan took the new line public in a speech on January 16th, when he said, "We are determined to deal with our differences peacefully through negotiations." He also touched again on the vision he had evoked when he made his Star Wars proposal. "As I have said before, my dream is to see the day when nuclear weapons will be banished from the face of the earth." After a while, the Soviets began to soften as well. Andropov died that February, and his successor, Konstantin Chernenko, signaled that he might be willing to talk about arms cuts. He attached a condition, however, that Reagan wasn't willing to go for. Chernenko wanted Reagan to drop Star Wars. The Soviets feared the technology could enable the United States to launch a first strike without fear of retaliation. Throughout, the intelligence community was struggling to keep up with these events. The CIA launched a study to try to figure out why the Soviets seemed to have gotten so edgy, and as U.S. satellites captured the first images of Soviet missile tests in the Arctic, Naval Intelligence and the NSA began anxiously planning Parchi's return to the Barents. Parchi left for the Barents shortly after yet another diplomatic scuffle, in which the Soviets boycotted the Olympic Games in Los Angeles, answering the U.S. boycott of the Games in Moscow 4 years earlier. When she returned, it was clear that she had brought home far more than even the most optimistic intelligence officials had hoped for. The taps had been recording all through the alert sparked by Able Archer and had captured a detailed look at the Soviet Navy's nuclear strategy. This was an ear to the Soviet Navy's nuclear command and control structure, as it was placing some of its missile submarines on high alert, rehearsing for war. Some former intelligence officials say this information simply confirmed the picture that had been emerging from the taps about how the Soviets planned to use their missile subs. But other former CIA, NSA, and Navy officials say that Parchi's take from this mission was so critical to their understanding of the Soviets that it qualified as the Big Casino, or the Crown Jewels. Based on the tap data, they say U.S. intelligence realized that some information collected by human agents had been dead wrong. The tap recordings chronicled the dispersal of key Soviet ships and submarines and offered a new picture of the state of Soviet readiness. Just as some of the younger Navy analysts had postulated years earlier, the emphasis was going to be on protecting missile subs. In the early days of a crisis, the Soviets planned to move some of their Typhoons and Deltas into safe bastions. Those bastions would be guarded by the bulk of Soviet attack subs and warships. Attack vessels would also ride shotgun as the missile subs made a dash for the safety of the Arctic ice. This was the strategy that had so worried the Pentagon. The Soviets had engineered a way to avoid NATO forces waiting to attack at the mouth of the GI-UK gap, as well as any NATO sub that tried to follow Soviet boats into the Barents. Still, Parchi had carried home confirmation of one more crucial fact that eased the Pentagon's worst fears. The Soviet Union was not preparing for a first strike from the sea. As one former intelligence official says of the tap data, both from this and other missions, "It conveyed a notion that while preemptive war was an option, the Soviet forces were not designed to go for a first strike." The bottom line was this. The balance of power was changing. Soviet technological advances, the increased missile ranges, the hardening of submarine sails and hulls to withstand the ice, had placed the Soviet Union on the verge of achieving nuclear parity with the United States in the last major area where it had lagged behind. Now that the Soviet Union could better protect its missile subs, it had in its grasp that all-important strategic reserve, a nearly invulnerable second strike force. In the Soviets' view, this would make it even less likely that the United States would ever launch a first strike against them. President Reagan was briefed on the findings, but he left it largely to the Navy and Defense Secretary Weinberger to grapple with the strategic military implications. Lehman and Watkins had been arguing for several years that if war came, the Navy would have to go up under the ice and try to root out the Soviet missile submarines, and they now decided to make this the Navy's official strategy. Their decision was based in part on extensive war games, in which U.S. officials had been asked to act as they thought Soviet commanders would. And there were assumptions made, most notably that any major crises would take months to build, giving the Navy plenty of time to flood attack subs into the Barents, pick up Soviet missile subs leaving port, and tag them, follow them to their patrol areas. Heady from their successes trailing submarines in the deepest waters of the Arctic, most admirals didn't want to hear Lyon's continued warnings that it was a lot easier to play tag than hide and seek. He was certain that the Soviets could lose a trail easily where the U.S. subs couldn't find them, in the shallow water marginal ice zones. The admirals were even less interested these days in his critiques of the design modifications for the new L.A.-class submarines. In fact, after 40 years as the Navy's key Arctic expert, Lyon was inexplicably under orders to stay away from the redesign of the L.A.-class boats. Navy leaders acknowledge that the sub-force would have taken big losses by trying to blast into the Soviet bastions, or roust their missile subs from under the ice. but they also say they had no doubt that they could have beaten many of the Soviet subs to their war positions. To test that theory, they sent more than 24 attack subs surging from Atlantic ports toward the Soviet Union one Sunday. Every intelligence sensor was aimed at recording the Soviets' reaction, and not a single one picked up any sign that the scramble had been noticed. Besides that, Navy leaders were counting on the fact that U.S. crews were better trained than their Soviet counterparts and had spent far more time at sea, given how much of the Soviet fleet was usually broken down and out of service. And if the Soviets were willing to confine themselves to the Arctic and their home waters, the U.S. subs would know roughly where to hunt their prey. They also would have prior knowledge of favorite Soviet patrol areas from surveillance ops, and from the sonobuoys now peppering the marginal ice, where SOSUS didn't reach. The limits and the advantages of the U.S. strategy were voiced most bluntly by Watkins, who was the chief of naval operations from mid-1982 until mid-1986. He says the Soviet strategy of pulling back their missile subs was probably smart, and initially did make it more difficult to destroy them. But he also believed that if the Soviets started a nuclear war with land missiles, the United States could eliminate a very large percentage of the missile subs that they would have positioned to make a second strike from the sea. Still, any strategy that allowed for even a few enemy missile subs to fire at U.S. targets was a far cry from the days when most of the Soviet Yankees traveled the seas with unknown and lethal shadows that could prevent them from shooting at all. And for intelligence officials, it was a huge relief to realize that the Soviets were not readying to use their improved position to start a war. Ironically, the 1984 run, the trip that brought home the big casino, was the first of Parchee's 5 missions to the Barents that would fail to win a presidential unit citation. Instead, Parchee was given a Navy unit commendation, the next highest award. Parchee may have supplied the United States with an amazing wealth of critical information, but her own role in the ongoing Cold War drama was becoming more routine. Actually, naval intelligence was now hatching a plan to access the Soviet cable in real time without having to wait for a submarine to travel there at all. The concept had been kicking around Nuro since the mid-1970s, when some officials envisioned linking the Okhotsk tap by cable to Japan. John Butts, the director of naval intelligence, and his team were now pushing an ambitious idea to lay 1,200 miles of cable between the Barents taps and Greenland. He envisioned barges that would look so perfectly innocuous that no one would ever dream that they were involved in stretching and laying his imagined cable, and he saw a full-time staff of linguists and cryptologists dedicated to translating and decoding the material as it came in. The plan was grand. In fact, it was grandiose. Some of Butts's colleagues began to joke that he was trying to take over the world. They watched, wondering whether Butts and his aides would realize they were getting more than a little carried away. They waited as Butts tallied up the $1 billion cost. The intelligence committees in Congress didn't wonder or wait. They simply made it clear they were going to sink Butts's plan, barges and all. Throughout all of this, the two superpowers continued talking about shedding, or at least shrinking, their nuclear arsenals. And when Chernenko died in March 1985, the old Soviet guard all but died with him. For its new leader, the Politburo reached into a younger generation to find 54-year-old Mikhail Gorbachev. He had been convinced ever since the Abel Archer panic that the Soviet Union had to get back to the negotiating table. Now, as he took up his post as General Secretary, He seemed more willing than any of his recent predecessors to consider major changes in U.S.-Soviet relations. Indeed, he made his first move late on the day of Chernenko's funeral. The USSR has never intended to fight the United States and does not have such intentions now, Gorbachev flatly declared to Bush and Shultz. There have never been such madmen within the Soviet leadership, and there are none now. During these first steps toward conciliation, U.S. authorities made startling discoveries that reminded the nation that the days of spies and old-style cold warriors were not over. Rich Haver, it seems, hadn't been seeing ghosts at all. It was early in 1985 when Bill Studeman, who was about to succeed Butz as Director of Naval Intelligence, walked into Haver's office with a critical piece of paper. Haver, who was now the Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence, took it and read through the FBI's account of an interview with a woman named Barbara Walker, who had come to report that her husband, a former Navy chief, had been spying for the Soviets. The FBI noted that Walker had been living the good life, although his only visible means of support was a failing detective business. Haver knew instantly that he was holding the answer that he and Studeman had sought back in the late 1970s, when they tried to convince admirals to investigate a possible communications break. John A. Walker, Jr., was a retired Navy submariner and communications specialist. In 1967, he had been a watch officer in Norfolk, handling communications with American submarines in the Atlantic. He had access to reports on submarine operations, technical manuals, and the daily key lists that were used to unscramble all of the messages sent through the military's most widely used coding machines. If the Soviets had gotten hold of any of this, they would have known that they needed to look over their shoulders, that their missile subs were being followed by much quieter U.S. subs. They also would have known just how quiet U.S. submarines were, and just how critical submarine quieting technology was to the balance of ocean power. Later, Haver and Studeman learned that Walker had given all this to the Soviets, and more. Walker's espionage had given the Soviets the warning and the motivation they needed to pull off a master stroke in this cold war under the seas. They would make their subs much harder to trail by hiding them far closer to home. In fact, when Walker retired from the Navy in 1976, he had continued his espionage by drawing others into his scheme. First, he recruited another Navy communications specialist, Jerry A. Whitworth, who continued Walker's access to the crucial key lists. In the early 1980s, Walker enlisted his brother, Arthur, who worked for a defense contractor. And soon after that, Walker began using his son, Michael, an enlisted man on the USS Nimitz, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Walker was caught only because his ex-wife wanted to prevent him from recruiting their daughter into a spy ring that had already swallowed their son. The news was sobering. For all the years that the United States had been eavesdropping on the Soviets through the cable taps, the Soviets had been listening in on U.S. communications, and without the years of research, investment in technology, or risk to men's lives. In fact, Walker's ring had cost the Soviets less than $1 million over 18 years. And for that money, he had almost single-handedly destroyed the U.S. nuclear advantage. Walker was arrested on May 20th. The next day, Haver was assigned to write the damage report, largely because he had written much of it 10 years earlier, when he first tried to raise the alarm. But the damage was worse than even Haver had predicted. Walker also had passed crucial secrets about U.S. techniques for quieting subs, such as cushioning engine equipment to prevent vibrations from resonating through hulls. Indeed, around the time Walker was caught, U.S. sonar operators were reporting that they couldn't identify some of the newest Soviet attack subs until their own boats were right on top of the Soviets, or in some cases, were surprised by them. A few of the newest Soviet subs, the Sierras and Aquilas, were in fact nearly as silent as the U.S. Sturgeon class. It later turned out that the Soviets also had been helped by Japanese and Norwegian companies, including a subsidiary of Toshiba Corporation, which had surreptitiously sold them the huge computer-guided milling machines needed to make the propeller blades on Soviet subs much smoother and quieter. Studeman later testified before a federal judge, saying that Walker's ring might have had powerful war-winning implications for the Soviet side. And when Vitaly Yurchenko, a high-ranking KGB officer, defected in July 1985, he told the CIA that the Walker-Whitworth ring was the most important espionage victory in KGB history. Walker pleaded guilty that October and agreed to help authorities assess the damage in exchange for leniency for his son. The elder Walker received a single life sentence, with eligibility for parole after 10 years. The deal was approved by Defense Secretary Weinberger, but Navy Secretary Lehman was furious. In his eyes, Walker's treachery was being treated as just another white-collar crime. Lehman rhapsodized that if it had been up to him, he would have applied one of the penalties for treason from back in the days following the American Revolution. The essence, as Lehman quoted it, was that you be hanged by the neck, but not until you are dead, but that you be taken down again, and whilst you are yet alive, your bowels be taken out and burnt before your face, and that afterwards your head be severed from your body, and your body divided into four quarters. And may God Almighty have mercy on your soul. A month after Walker was sentenced, Lehman had one more body for his imagined gallows, and Haver had caught his second ghost. This time it was Yurchenko who offered up the Navy's second spy. Back in January 1980, when Yurchenko was working in the Soviet embassy in Washington, he had fielded a call from a man who would only say, "I have some information to discuss with you and to give to you." The caller visited the embassy, but Yurchenko never learned his name or what he had to offer. Other Soviet agents had taken the case. That wasn't much to go on, but it turned out to be enough. The FBI began going through old recordings of Yurchenko's conversations that had been captured by wiretaps. Investigators found the call and played it back for some NSA employees. They recognized the voice. Yurchenko's mystery caller turned out to be Ronald W. Pelton, a former NSA employee who was arrested on November 25, 1985. Some of the information he had been offering the Soviets turned out to be the Navy's top-secret Okhotsk cable-tapping operation. Pelton had sold out the Okhotsk taps for $35,000. In an attempt to mask his own bankruptcy, he had exposed the nation's most critical submarine spy missions and risked the lives of the men on both Seawolf and Parchee. Both subs had been sent to Okhotsk during the nearly 2 years that elapsed before the Soviets found the tap pods. Just why it took the Soviets so long to follow up on Pelton's tip remains unclear. After Pelton was arrested, the Navy finally turned over Haver's old report to the Senate Intelligence Committee, the one he had written in January 1982, outlining his suspicions that a spy was responsible for the loss of the Okhotsk tap. The senators were furious. At a closed hearing, they lambasted Navy representatives for withholding the report for 3 years, and they were indignant that the Navy had risked 140 men's lives, sending Parchee right back to the Barents, despite Haver's suspicions that there was a spy. William Cohen, a Republican from Maine, was one of the angriest lawmakers in the room. Cohen, who would become Secretary of Defense under President Bill Clinton, demanded to know who had written the report. From the back of the room, Haver stood up. "Sir, I wrote the report." When one of the senators wanted to know how he could be so sure that this was his work, Haver cited the report's date and noted that he wasn't about to forget his own birthday. Cohen wanted to know why the Navy failed to react to Haver's conclusion that the Soviets probably had foreknowledge of the cable tap. He wanted to know why nobody searched for a spy. "They didn't believe it," Haver responded. Cohen pressed on. Was it prudent, he wanted to know, to continue to operate the cable tapping program, push it full tilt ahead, when there may have been a spy? All Haver could do was repeat what he had said, that nobody believed he was right, that others in naval intelligence had failed to reach the same conclusion. Finally, in a gesture of loyalty, he tossed in that there had been some ambiguity. He did not say that he had never had any doubt, that he had known all along there was probably only one way to add up the facts. There was one good bit of news for the Navy and the NSA in Pelton's arrest. Now that they knew who the spy was, they also knew that the Barents tap was still secure. Pelton's job and his security clearances simply hadn't stretched that far. As long as he was in the dark, so were the Soviets. Pelton pleaded not guilty, and his trial was scheduled for May 1986. But that created another problem. Somehow the Navy and the NSA had to keep the glare of the trial off Parchee, away from the Barents, and clear of yet another mission. It wasn't hard to persuade a judge to agree to keep the proceedings devoid of any real details. But Bob Woodward and other Washington Post reporters were already digging on their own. They had a cable-tapping story ready for the Post's front page. Navy and NSA officials were frantic. Seawolf was in the Mediterranean at that moment trying to tap a cable that ran from West Africa to Europe as she sought to help out in a showdown with Libyan leader Muammar el-Qaddafi. Seawolf was working side by side in the Mediterranean with the NR-1 mini-submarine, though their efforts would not yield any worthwhile information. Not only that, but Parchee was going to head back out to the Barents later in the year. She had to. The Soviets were being more aggressive than ever in the Atlantic. They had just sent a cluster of 5 Victor-class attack subs, and for 3 weeks kept them so close to the east coast of the United States that tracking them almost used up the Atlantic Fleet's store of sonobuoys. An article now could be devastating. CIA Director William Casey threatened to prosecute the Post for revealing intelligence secrets. Reagan personally telephoned the Post's publisher, Catherine Graham, beseeching her not to publish, as priceless secrets were at stake. In the end, the Post ran a limited story the day before Pelton's trial began. The article said little more than that Pelton had betrayed a high-tech and long-running submarine operation to intercept Soviet communications in Okhotsk. There was no mention of Halibut, Seawolf, or Parchee. Not a word about the Barents or Libya. The trial disclosed no further details, and in early June Pelton was convicted and given 3 consecutive life sentences, plus 10 years. Their secret safe, Parchee's crew shoved off in early September with Commander Richard A. Buchanan at the helm. This was the sub's 7th Barents journey, the 6th trip via the Arctic route, and the 2nd trip with Buchanan as her captain. It was a trip that would stand out from all the rest. Pelton's trial had left the crew nervous. By now, they would all had to have been lobotomized, not to know that they were about to replicate the very sort of operation Pelton had given away to the Soviets. The code name from Pelton's day, Ivy Bells, was dead. Now there were a series of new codes, including Manta for the overall operation, and Acetone for the tap itself, and even those codes were being changed continuously. The men knew, however, that whatever the NSA called the operation, The Soviets had been given a look at their strategies, at their plans, at how they did business. Crew members talked about Pelton and the man they had come to call Johnny Walker Red, often late into the night. They thought about how much classified information each man on Parchee had handled, how many stacks of crypto material could easily have found their way to a photocopying machine if just one of them had the itch. They also talked about how hard the Navy had tried to keep secret from them the details of their own missions. It was galling. Secrecy, the men knew, couldn't be achieved through any terrific security measures, and it couldn't be preserved by trying to keep the guys on the boat in the dark. It could only be maintained because the men themselves found the idea of selling out to the Soviets unthinkable. And it could be lost when just one of them decided that maybe selling out wasn't so unthinkable after all. Still, as the boat made her way toward the Barents, the men also had a sense of payback and daring. The Soviets may have had Pelton and Walker, but the United States had Parchee. And by now, her crew had the drill down cold. The trip through the Arctic went well. Parchee was 20 or 30 miles from where she would retrieve the tap pods and plant new ones. She had already charted the corridor, the route she would take closer to Soviet shores. Over the years, various U.S. submarines had played chicken with the sonar buoys the Soviets had set up to pop out of the water and transmit should a sub try to pass. Before Parchee arrived at the Barents, the buoys were all mapped out, the ones that worked, the ones that were duds. All she had to do was take a path through the duds, move in a little closer, and bend to the left. Then the message came. Hold off. Wait. Don't move. Parchee was by now just outside the 12-mile limit, but her path in was now sealed by presidential order. On September 19th, while Parchee was still en route, Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze had delivered a letter to Reagan from Gorbachev. The General Secretary had written that he wanted to push the arms negotiations along by meeting with Reagan. He gave two choices of locales, and the United States picked Reykjavik, Iceland, a quiet spot halfway between Washington and Moscow. The meeting was set for October 11, 1986, a follow-up to the previous year's summit. At that meeting, there had been one sticking point, and that was Star Wars. Gorbachev wanted SDI eliminated. Reagan passionately insisted that SDI was the only way out of the precarious balance built on mutually assured destruction. He believed his lasers in space could forever erase the concept that peace depended on the threat that the United States and the Soviet Union could wipe each other out. During that last meeting, discussion had often deteriorated into a shouting match. But in the heat of battle, Reagan and Gorbachev came to like and respect one another. In the end, they also came out with a joint statement saying they wanted to work toward a 50% reduction in strategic weapons and other arms cuts. This second act being staged in Reykjavik promised to be the most unpredictable and remarkable superpower meeting ever. Both sides had agreed that rather than scripting everything in advance, they would just clear space for the two leaders to talk. No wonder there were such high hopes for this summit. No wonder Gorbachev unwittingly halted Parchee in her tracks with his letter. On board, the sense of history about to happen was lost on the men. They were certain they would be sent in to finish their task. For them, the summit just meant an uncomfortable and possibly dangerous wait. "Let's get in, let's get out," one of the men began grumbling over and over to anyone who would listen. After a while, they were all saying it, in one way or another. They were so close to the prize, could almost see it, smell it. But their orders were to pull back, not to touch it. It was irritating. It was worse than that. There was too much time to think, too much time to listen, as one warship after another passed nearby. There was too much time to recognize that the president didn't want to be anywhere around if Parche was caught. The men had always known that what they were doing was illegal, and that if Parche were ever found or forced to self-destruct, the United States would deny they had ever been there. It was just that now the message was louder than they wanted to hear. A week passed. Then, too, Parche was waiting, and by now, so was the rest of the world. October 11th came. Men crammed into Parche's radio room all day, trying to copy the news on the radio circuits, trying to follow what was going on. But neither they nor anyone on shore were allowed to hear the details. That had been the deal. No reporters, no reports. Not until it was all over. Reagan and Gorbachev were meeting in Hofde House, an isolated structure on the bleak edge of the North Atlantic. Schultz thought it looked haunted, and Icelanders were convinced that it was. They sat in a small room, Schultz and Shevardnadze, Reagan and Gorbachev, two translators and two note-takers. There, against a single window, looking out onto turbulent and frigid waters that would perhaps ultimately wash over to where Parche sat beneath the Barents, the summit began. Compromises were offered and concessions were made. Staff negotiators agreed that they could cut ballistic missile arsenals in half to roughly 6,000 warheads and 1,600 delivery vehicles on each side, and that they could also slash the number of shorter-range missiles. Reagan and Gorbachev themselves were talking about making these cuts over the next 5 years, and then eliminating the rest of their nuclear arsenals within 5 years after that. It was on the table, 10 years to a nuke-free world. They were actually talking about the end of the terrors that had existed since the Manhattan Project, talking about forever rendering false Robert J. Oppenheimer's horrifying 1945 prophecy, "I am become death, destroyer of worlds." A quote from the Bhagavad Gita that the physicist intoned after the first atomic bomb had been tested. Gorbachev still wanted Reagan to give up SDI, or at least limit Star Wars research to the laboratory, and to agree to refrain from testing in space for 10 years. Reagan wanted to conduct space tests, at least enough of them so that SDI could be deployed in 10 years. At that time, he promised the United States would hand the entire system, all of the technology, over to the Soviets. Gorbachev wasn't buying it, and Reagan pleaded for resolution. "I have a picture that after 10 years, you and I come to Iceland and bring the last two missiles in the world, and we have the biggest damn party in celebration of it." He continued, "A meeting in Iceland in 10 years. I'll be so old you won't recognize me. I'll say, 'Mikhail?' You'll say, 'Ron?' And we'll destroy the last two." They parried. Gorbachev said he might not be alive in 10 years, that he was just entering his danger period, and that Reagan had passed through his and could now count on making it smoothly to age 100. "I can't live to 100 worrying that you'll shoot one of those missiles at me," Reagan answered. The argument went on. Reagan insisted that he had promised the American people he wouldn't give up SDI. Gorbachev insisted that the president would still have SDI even if he confined testing to the lab. Finally, Reagan spoke the words that might have sounded like just so much lofty rhetoric in any other context. "It would be fine with me if we eliminated all nuclear weapons." "We can do that. Let's eliminate them." "We can eliminate them," Gorbachev shot back. This could have been the defining moment. Maybe it should have been. But Hofde House was living up to its reputation. The men were indeed haunted by this single impasse. "It is a question of one word," Reagan said, pleading for Gorbachev to give up his insistence that SDI proceed only in the laboratory. "It's laboratory or goodbye," Gorbachev insisted. The meeting ended on that note. Outside, a crush of international press was learning how close the two had come to an agreement. Reporters were rushing off to wire the world their postmortems that would declare the summit a failure. Beneath the water, another wire reached Parchi. Word shot through the sub as a single line was quoted throughout the boat. "You are authorized to penetrate the 12-mile line." Parchi was going in. She was now only 6 or 7 hours away from her mission. Conversation on board turned to other missions, other close calls. It was how the men admitted, without admitting, how scared they were. They talked about tracking Yankees and the ultra-quiet new Akula and Sierra attack submarines that had come out in the last couple of years. They called the Akula the Walker Sub, because the spy had inspired the Soviet move toward deadly quiet engines. In fact, Soviet technology was moving ahead so fast that more U.S. attack subs were being detected by the Soviet boats they were trying to trail. American subs were also being detected near the Soviet coasts. It was there that the spooks would hear the Soviets react in a burst of messages. The spooks had taken to calling the Soviet detection warning Stutter 9. In their code, 8 bursts meant a suspected detection, 9 meant one confirmed. The stutter came from repetition. The men talked about all this, knowing all the while that on Parchi detection was likely to mean self-destruction. Maybe it was to avoid that fear that just about everyone was getting E.B. Greened to the walls these days, Pharaoh's tomb under the Barents. But the mission was unfolding without a hitch. The divers went out, the spooks listened, the divers retrieved the pods and left others in place to keep collecting. Slowly, quietly, Parchi began the trip away from the cable to the point where she could signal the companion sub that all was well. That's when they felt, heard, the ping, that awful sound of active sonar ringing through the hull. Someone above knew a submarine was there. Fortunately, there were two, Parchi and her escort sub. Some recall the USS Finback, SSN 670. Finback quickly moved in, got the Soviets' attention, acted like this was just another game of tag under the sea. It worked. Parchi stole away. They were hundreds of miles from the moor when they popped up an antenna. With sonar making certain no one was around, they sent a quick message to Washington. Mission accomplished. It took Parchi about a month to reach the waters outside San Diego, where she stopped briefly on her way home. Bruce DeMars, who was now the admiral in charge of submarines, came out in a small motorboat to meet her and ride back to port with the men. He was ecstatic. Casually dressed, he made it clear that nobody had to put on the spit and shine for him, not on this run, anyway. DeMars carried his congratulations and videotaped copies of the New York Mets battling their way through 7 games of the World Series. Baseball was the theme on the ride back to port. As usual, the men's families, wives, and girlfriends were waiting for them on the pier when they arrived. In Washington, someone else awaited Buchanan. President Reagan wanted to meet this captain, wanted to personally congratulate the man who had earned Parche yet another PUC. It would be Parche's 5th, on top of the 3 NUCs she also had won. The way the crew heard it, the brass was all there. The President, Vice President Bush, the CNO, members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Buchanan stood there, commander of the Navy's most sensitive spy sub, feeling like an E-1, the lowest-ranking man on a sub. Certainly, he was the lowest-ranking man in the room. Then Reagan looked him in the eye and called him a modern-day John Wayne. It was the part of the story that Buchanan's men liked best. They figured Reagan had to be sincere. He had known John Wayne. Chapter 12 Trust, but Verify. If the Cold War wasn't quite over, it was definitely beginning to wane. Reykjavik had been the start, and both sides seemed to sense it. Even as the U.S. Navy gave chase to a cluster of Soviet Victor III attack subs off the East Coast in 1987, and as U.S. subs continued their pace of spy missions, something was changing, something that was at first almost intangible. To be sure, Gorbachev continued to bristle about Star Wars and blew up in frustration at nearly every meeting with Shultz, at least once because he was convinced that the American people would never forgive Soviet acts of aggression, dating back to the 1960 shoot-down of Gary Powers in his U-2 spy plane. But these tirades were almost all over the failure to reach a peace soon enough, or deep enough. Just 2 years after the paranoid reign of Andropov, the Soviet Union was saying it had had enough. In fact, in May 1987, the Soviets announced a formal military doctrine, one aimed simply at defending their homeland. That December, Reagan and Gorbachev met in Washington, D.C. for the first follow-up summit to Reykjavik. They finally signed a treaty to eliminate an entire class of nuclear arms, the intermediate-range nuclear forces. It was the angry impasse over a similar INF treaty that in 1983 had made some top Soviet officials fear that the United States was considering a first strike. Now, as both sides agreed to sign, there was only a shadow of the old hostilities.
Doverye na proverye. Trust, but verify, Reagan said, evoking an old Russian maxim at the signing. You repeat that at every meeting, Gorbachev teased, chuckling. I like it, Reagan agreed.
Who could have imagined Ronald Reagan kidding around with a Soviet leader? These two men were so ebullient that Gorbachev stopped his motorcade on the way to the White House so he could shake hands with the crowd. Reagan answered at the next summit by allowing Gorbachev to introduce him to the Soviet people milling about Red Square. Georgi Arbatov, the director of the Soviet Union's Institute for the Study of the USA and Canada, put it all into words. We are going to do something terrible to you. We are going to deprive you of an enemy. Still, while Gorbachev and Reagan had set the tone, it was going to take both sides some time to accept the enormity of what was happening, to believe that this friendship could last, and that the Cold War was really coming to an end. That much was clear as the top men in uniform began holding summits of their own. Admiral William J. Crow, Jr., chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, met Marshal Sergei Akhramayev, the chief of staff of the Soviet Armed Forces. The marshal and the Joint Chiefs mixed socially. Crow took Akhramayev on a guided tour of a U.S. aircraft carrier. They even met in the Pentagon's tank, the secure room where top U.S. military men planned their moves against the Soviets. Still, as Akhramayev sat with the Americans talking about newfound friendship, he could not disguise his frustrations over U.S. sub-spying and tracking operations, which seemed unchanged from Cold War days.
You're the problem,
he blurted out at Admiral Carlisle A.H. Trost, now the Chief of Naval Operations. Not only were U.S. subs still lurking off Soviet waters, but Akhramayev was convinced that he could track all of his own subs by simply following the American P-3 Orion sub-hunters in the air. It was a stunning revelation of just how effective U.S. anti-submarine efforts continued to be. Trost simply tried to calm him down, saying that U.S. strategy was not intended to threaten anyone. But even as he faced Akhramayev, Trost realized he was being given a look deep inside the Soviet psyche, and what he saw was different from what he had long believed. It had once all seemed so clear to him that Soviet forces were designed for aggression. But now Trost could see how strongly Akhramayev believed that he had only been part of an effort to defend his country, a country surrounded by enemies, by NATO ships, submarines, and airborne subhunters. Gradually, these men from such different worlds were breaking through to one another. They were connecting and realizing just what a shared experience the Cold War had been. One telling moment came when Admiral Kennard McKee, one of the Navy's most successful subcaptains, Whitey Mack's chief nemesis back in the Lapon days, the man who had later become Rickover's successor as the submarine force's nuclear czar, sat swapping sea stories with a top Soviet admiral at a luncheon at the Pentagon. Also there was Rich Haver. When he was introduced as a naval intelligence analyst, Haver heard the Soviet translator mutter to his admiral, K.A. Makarov, something about CIA. The tense moment seemed to pass as McKee sat with his guest of honor, blowing the old ballast tanks. McKee reminisced about his days as a captain of the USS Dace. At the time, Makarov had his own command of a 671 Project sub, the kind, he pointed out helpfully, the Americans called Victor. Then Makarov let slip that he had been near the Dace on one of its patrols, that he had known it was the Dace even then. "I wonder who trailed whom," Haver said, knowing quite well that it was McKee's spotting and trailing of the first Victor during its sea trials in 1968 that had helped launch the admiral's career. Makarov gave Haver an icy stare and continued staring as he offered his answer through his interpreter. "Now is not the time to discuss that." But that look said more. It seemed to acknowledge, "I know who trailed whom, and it wasn't me." These were old wounds, and Haver had supplied the salt. He had reminded the Soviets of the long years when they were behind, when they could have been called downright inept. They may have closed the gap in the final years of the Cold War, but that hadn't eased the humiliation. Haver had broken a rule of this special glasnost, of this still new and uneasy openness among military men. And when lunch was over, Makarov made that clear. "Tell this young man that when veterans get together, it doesn't matter who won or lost," he said through his translator. "It's enough that both survived." Although Makarov's use of the past tense may have been a bit premature, it certainly fit the Soviet perspective. After that flurry of activity off the American coast in 1986 and 1987, Soviet submarines had